So who here knows a bit of German? Deutsch.
Claire knows
ein
a bit.
Bisschen. Nur ein bisschen.
Oh, my only bit is Zweistopper Weimar.
Ein bisschen means a little.
Yeah.
I was 19 at the time and I was hitchhiking. I'd gone all around Italy, right? I was coming back up to Munich, right? Yeah, it was October, right? And the festival was on. The beer festival.
Oktoberfest.
Oktoberfest, yeah. So I went along anyway. And I had fuck all money, right? But I met these fellas and they were selling yolks that you put around your neck and that are luminous, right? They shine in the dark, right? I got talking to them and they wanted to know that I wanted a bit of work for the night. And I said, yeah, sure, yeah. So they said, okay, you sell, I think it's 2 for 3 marks. Zweistück per 3 marks. Is that 2 for 3 marks?
Yeah. Sounds like it.
That's the only German words I ever knew in my life.
2 pieces for 3 marks. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah.
Stuck is
so
a piece.
Anyway, they were a bit of a con job, really, right? But I was a good salesman, right? So I sold loads of them, right? And I was a whore to sell stuff, right? It wasn't my first time selling stuff. And I was making money so I could drink beer, right? Some smart ones came along then, right? And they got someone that could speak English and they started complaining that the thing had stopped shining, right? Because, see, it's freezing, right? And it only shines when it's really cold, right? And when it gets warm, right, the shine goes off it, right? So they said, oh, no, this is a con job. It didn't work, you know. It doesn't shine anymore. And I said, oh, Jesus Christ, you didn't follow the instructions, I said, you know. And I said, what do you mean? I said, they work forever, I said. They can last forever. But I said, you can only wear them for about an hour, I said. And then you must run home and put in the deep freeze for about a half an hour. Then you can wear it for another hour. Put in the deep freeze for half an hour. Wear it for another hour. And I said all this real fast.
So auf Deutsch.
Oh no, it was all in English. I had no word of German, right? They had got people who boasted that they could speak English well, right? So I made fucking sure they didn't understand my Irish accent at speed.
Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness. Madness. This is madness. We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on 3 occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the net to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say, so what?
The police in riot gear with trunks. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
The recognition of Guaido,
unelected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and I would reprimand you over that.
Where have you been in Germany?
I did my kind of Erasmus equivalent in Berlin before the wall came down. I worked for Siemens. Yeah, no, it was really interesting time, actually, yeah. Different in the old East Berlin
how
and
long
West
was
Berlin.
That?
I was there for 3 months. It was a long time ago, Dean. I can't remember now, but it was, I would have been in the 80s, you know, in the mid to late 80s before the wall came down. But no, it was an interesting spot to be, completely different than it is now. It's become a real cosmopolitan hotspot now at this stage.
Anyway, if you haven't noticed, we're talking Germany for good reasons. This is episode 19, I think, of I Foresee Trouble with Daly and Wallace. And you've been listening to Daly and Wallace. So we're talking about the Germans because our episode today is about the German presidency of the EU Council. So the Germans are back in town. They're in charge. They've taken over from the 1st of July till the 31st of December. It's a rotating presidency. So it's their turn now. Then it'll be Portugal and Slovenia. So this is a 6-month term where they're the ones in charge of the council. And then it goes on to the next, and they work in threes. Ireland last had the presidency, you might remember, 2013. Next time we'll have it is 2026, so a bit to go. We won't be around, probably. we'll see what happens. And that was under the esteemed leadership of Enda Kenny, you might remember.
Great success. Actually, I think there was a really interesting, the Corporate Observatory Europe have done an analysis of Germany and their role in terms of the corporate capture of them and some of the lobbying by big business, particularly in the energy sector, and how that's infiltrated into the German position at European Council level and how it's led to a watering down of many of the standards. And the irony in that we look to the Germans as being the innovators and the cleanest energy provider, but behind the scenes there aren't. But they tell a story in that of how when Enda Kenny was the main man in 2013 and there was a compromise position put and about to be agreed at council level, on CO2 emissions, and Merkel rang Enda Kenny and asked him to get the item removed from the agenda, which Enda duly obliged. And in the intervening time, the Germans managed to go on a love bomb or a persuasive influencing whatever. They used the time well to get the other member states to change their mind, and the job was done and the emissions were watered down. So that was the last time Ireland was president.
You might say.
Yeah, so and Merkel's story as well.
Well,
yeah.
Of course, Fine Gael as well are best buds with the German Christian Democrats who are in power. That's Angela Merkel's party. So yeah, Angela is president. She's back. And the funny thing is, the last time the Germans had the EU presidency was in 2007, which was also Angela Merkel. So she's one of the few people, if only people, to ever have the presidency more than once. You can see it doesn't come around very often. And we had her over in the parliament. So let's hear what she had to say.
This is my first trip since the pandemic started, and I deliberately chose to come here to the heart of European democracy at a time when the European Union wishes to stand resolute in the face of this crisis. At such a time, the EU needs the European Parliament. There are huge challenges ahead that require enormous effort. We need parliamentary debate. We need political coordination, cultural translation and mediation between different countries and regions. And so we need you. And it is a particular honour for me today to present the priorities of the German presidency. There are five priorities, I feel, at the current juncture. Fundamental rights, cohesion, climate protection, digitalization, and Europe's responsibility in the world. These five priorities are very important because we need sustainable change in Europe to safeguard, preserve Europe.
So that was Angela Merkel speaking in the European Parliament in the plenary session to the MEPs. Mick, what do you make of it?
She didn't say a whole lot. Said a lot of nice things, but it didn't necessarily amount to much. Listen, she's been a formidable player. Obviously, aside from her politics, she has been probably the strongest leader in Europe for many, many years. There was a real buzz around the place because she was around, because she's a bit of a celebrity, really, in political terms. And so everybody was eager to get an opportunity to see her in person and listen to her. But listen, you know, it was a bit of a camouflage of what the Germans are probably doing in the Europe. And so it was hard to take it too serious, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's gas. Mick's talking about everybody wanted to get a piece of her. And I believe RTE showed Mick sitting in the background when she was speaking. Ironic how at every plenary he manages to pop up in the background.
It's
footage.
The hair.
Somehow, I don't know, or else maybe one of the cameramen has, or women have their eye on him. I don't know.
I hope I was wearing my mask, was I?
Oh, I think you were. Always a good boy. Always a good boy.
Once a good boy, always a good boy.
But on the other side, we were actually where we sit. We were quite near to where the council sit when they come in. But, you know, Mick's right. Like, I mean, people wanted to hear her, like, and it is an indication of the influence of Germany, but also, I suppose, a unique European role that she has played. There is no one like her in a European context in terms of what she represents. She kind of is Europe in some way. And I say that partly, ironically, partly not, because actually we would have made the point before that Germany has benefited more from the European Union than anyone else. And yet they play this role of being kind of facilitators and great compromisers and not so hawkish the French or that type of thing. So she is a bit of a powerhouse. Her method of presentation is very understated. I mean, in some ways it's a good thing. You compare it to Ursula von der Leyen, like, with the, you know, hair perfect, the real Stepford Wives sort of rehearsed dramatical language,
cheesy
yeah. You know, sort of international school taught English. Merkel isn't like that. She's much more gritty and real, but
that
she's
East
real
German vibe, you know,
from the point of view of business interests. And I think what her minister showed as they've come in before our committees,
yeah,
I think Mick said he's getting seriously worried, but I don't know what way you'd call it, but the Germans are here. There's no doubt about it. And their presence is already far in excess of anything in the 6 months of the six of the Croatian presidency. Might as well have not existed.
But when you think about it now, I mean, obviously we'll get around to talking about the different ministers that have been... we've got the opportunity to question in the last few days. They're seriously formidable. And while we don't like their politics, we'd be the first to acknowledge that they're very, very strong. And the funny part about it is, even though von der Leyen was a German minister of defence in her past life, she doesn't come across as being formidable. Mm. Von der Leyen is weak as water.
She's
really
from a political aristocracy, but never really...
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no substance to her. Yeah. And... she gets up and she's all shapes and has all the right slang words and it's
but
all...
she's saying nothing.
She's still the president of the commission.
She is. She was actually... she became president because
of that.
Because the powers that be, the big parties in the parliament, actually couldn't agree on some of the stronger candidates that were being recommended.
Yeah. Mm.
So she was actually a compromise candidate, and it's unfortunate because she is not strong.
Mm. So that is a good point. But when you think about it, right, so all of the ministers, and these are the guys we'll be talking about in a minute, all of the ministers for all of the countries meet on a regular basis under the Council of Europe. The transport ministers meet, the foreign affairs, justice, etc. And for us to see these men and women, like, and then we look and compare them with the lads at home and you go, oh, sacred heart of God, like, you can, these lads now would savage any one of most of the Irish representatives in those positions, like, you know, so it's a mix of terribly competent but terrible politics.
Well, talking about savaging and being formidable, right? One guy, and obviously we wouldn't be mad about his politics either. Phil Hogan is the commissioner over here, right?
Yeah.
And you know what now? You can say what you like about Big Phil, but Big Phil is formidable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's no one pushing Big Phil around.
Yeah.
He's well able to handle himself.
Yeah.
But I would actually say an awful lot of the commissioners this time are not strong.
Mm.
And the three German ministers that I've seen in the last week, by God, they are strong.
We'll get to the ministers later in the show, but just first to go back on what the German presidency is about. So their slogan is Together for Europe's Recovery. That's their motto. You'll see the presidencies are always very well branded and marketed. They all have their symbol that they have around the place for 6 months. They're really promoting their own countries as well, culturally, even over this period. And they also create a document, which is a program for presidency. So they outline their priorities, what they're going to do. And the guiding principles of Germany's council presidency are overcoming the COVID-19 pandemic permanently, as well as the economic recovery, a stronger and more innovative Europe, a fair Europe, a sustainable Europe, a Europe of security and common values, and a strong Europe in the world. Now, it's coming at a time, a very unique time of COVID, of this pandemic that we're not very well coping with, and then also the economic recovery to follow after that. A lot of people, I think, in Brussels at least, are saying that Germany is uniquely capable of taking on the presidency at this very timely moment. Do you think that they're the ones to do the job?
The Germans run the European Union in the interest of Germany first and the rest of the Europe after that. So from that point of view, I'm not so sure how much extra power comes with actually having the presidency. I really haven't got my head around that. I've got the impression, I mean, we've been here for the Croatians and the Finns already. And I didn't see their mark much on either of the 6 months, but we probably are more likely to see the mark of the Germans. I think the Germans kind of call the shots anyway, and I think they'll use the presidency to verbalise that and to lay down markers for everybody else. Mm. And so I do see them, as I was saying, I've met three of the ministers and I got the chance to question three of them. And I can definitely see them having a strong imprint on their portfolios, big time.
Yeah. And so the role of the presidency is a bit odd as well, because it sounds like a very powerful thing. But in the end of the day, it's about who's the one coordinating work in the council. So who's the one bringing together the ministers? Who's the one prioritizing what files? They get to make these kind of strategic decisions. But in the end of the day, they're also still stuck with the council's position, and the council works in a way where all the member states are valued more equally. So it's not like they have the reins and they can do what they like. We can see that in their policy throughout their programme for presidency. They're still very restricting themselves to what the council has already agreed upon. But they do broker what's happening, and they bring together the member states, and they come together with positions. Then they choose files, what ones they'll accelerate, what ones they'll slow down, because, of course, we can't work on everything at the same time. And the presidency basically becomes the key negotiator for every file over this six-month period. So when at the end of the six-month period, then we have the Portuguese will come in, and their big team of negotiators and ministers will become the negotiators for that file, the same files that if they're not completed for the next following 6 months. So the main engagement we have with the Parliament, with the Council, is in trilogues. These are the meetings where we're making the legislation, where the Parliament and the Council are head-on and battling it out between their two positions to find a common text. And that's when we have the minister. So, for instance, in environment, we've always had the environment minister, like in Austria, when the Austrian presidency was happening. They'd be there defending the mandate from the Council, and then the rapporteur, so that key negotiator in the Parliament, will be defending it for the Parliament. So that's our main contacts. Another place where I come across them a lot of the presidency is in climate change, because at the COP, the annual UNFCCC meeting that we have, the last one was in Madrid, we are represented by the Council presidency and the Commissioner. So they're the ones doing all the negotiations. They're running around meeting all the leaders, all these bilateral meetings, and they really have quite a powerful role there as well. So they do have it's a strange role. They're powerful in their coordination, and that, so that could be quite meaningful. But then at the end of the day, they don't get their way with everything. They still have to, they have other people, they have to satisfy other states, and they have to represent that common position. So maybe let's have a listen to the ministers. So maybe we'll start off with the environment minister. This is Svenja Schulze, and Mick, you had a chance to talk to her.
Minister, in January this year, the German Minister for Economic Affairs and Energy, Peter Altmaier, wrote a letter to President von der Leyen, which argued against more pollution limits for the car industry before 2030. One might expect the Minister for Environment to challenge Minister Altmaier, but Minister, you have taken a similar position to the Minister. You've taken the side of the German car industry on the issue of CO2 standards for cars. Last October, the same Minister said, "Gas is not only important, it's sexy." Germany's Gas 2030 strategy promotes more fossil gas infrastructure. I think the rest of Europe has a right to be concerned about the German presidency's influence on upcoming decisions on gas projects at EU level. A new coal-fired plant which has just been opened this year in Germany. Do you accept that Germany's coal, gas and car industry strategies are not compliant with the Paris Agreement? And will the German presidency commit to acting in the interest of all the people of the EU and not just in Germany's national interest and the interest of big business that wants to keep on polluting?
On individual industries, I can very clearly say that our government nor our council presidency is presenting industry interests. It's very important for all of us to work on a common strategy on decarbonizing our industries. We want industry to exist in Europe in the future as well, but it must be CO2 neutral. And the way to get there, well, for that, we have the European Green Deal. You have the different objectives within the European Green Deal, climate action, circular economy, biodiversity. These are all very important pillars that support this goal and bring it forward.
Yeah, look, I won't go back over the points I made when I put questions to her. She was pretty good at not answering the questions that I put to her. She avoided a lot of the points that I made. And but I tell you what now, from an environment point of view, I would be concerned. I did point out in my speech that she came down on the side of the car industry, as opposed to the issue of new standards, new CO2 standards for cars. If the Minister for Trade came up with that, you kind of say, well, listen, I understand that. But for the Minister for Environment to agree with that, is pretty scary. I think the Irish people at home should be aware of the fact that the Germans make a lot of cars. They make a lot of money selling cars outside of Europe as well. One of the driving forces behind Mercosur, where we are going to allow in contaminated meat from South America, so that in return for the Germans being allowed to sell more cars in South America without tariffs being placed on them. So really what you're having is you're having farmers in countries like Ireland being undermined with cheaper beef, contaminated beef, produced to lower regulation than what the Irish do. And in return, no, we don't make cars. The Germans do. And the Germans are going to make a lot more money from selling cars while we not only eat poorer quality meat, but we undermine the livelihoods of our own farmers in the process.
So yay or nay for the environment minister?
Didn't like her at all.
Okay.
But I tell you one thing, right? A serious woman, very, very strong.
Yeah, I think that goes for them all. The message I'm hearing from you is that they're all extremely competent, qualified people, proper ministerial ways of doing things.
I'd say she has nails for breakfast.
And Claire, you were chatting too. I keep saying chatting, but of course it was a formal committee where you were questioning and there was formal responses with the transport minister. So let's have a listen to that interaction.
I was very interested in the minister's contribution, although I must say I was very surprised that there wasn't a word said about the social abuses in aviation, even when you were asked the question. I mean, the backdrop of COVID has seen the airlines ride roughshod over the rights of passengers and trample on hard-won working conditions by their pilots, crew and other aviation staff. And I'm wondering, does the German presidency have nothing to say about this? Are you not concerned about the fact that billions of public money have gone into airline companies, the likes of Air France, KLM, where we've seen the chief executive get a bonus of €800,000 in the midst of the crisis, and almost 10 billion of public funds is used to let go almost 8,000 workers in aviation. Now, we also see that many workers will be, in the course of your presidency, on zero-hour contracts and probably receiving virtually no money by the low-cost carriers. So this has clearly huge safety implications, not to mind workers' rights. And I'm wondering, has the German presidency any interest in championing to outlaw atypical contracts of employment in aviation? Maybe you could lead the charge to see an end to bogus self-employment amongst air pilots and air cabin crew. Yeah, I mean, look, he wasn't very enlightening. I've even forgotten in many ways a lot of the things that he said, but I do think, and it's sort of related to the point that Mick made as well, what is incredibly interesting from all of their contributions is that these are individuals who clearly represent the interests of German capitalism in the main, which they see as being the key way of securing European capitalism. But, you know, that's if you want to secure capitalism at all. But in any case, obviously we don't. But Mick mentioned the car industry, and the Corporate Observatory report deals with how the German car industry has distorted a number of European decisions. I saw that as well in transport. Their same report looked at how they have sort of used or hidden behind alternative fuels. Liquid natural gas came up, that the transport minister was in favour of that as an alternative, an environmentally friendly measure. He was also pushing the idea of hydrogen. And again, this was something flagged in the Corporate Europe Observatory report, saying be careful that they are peddling this as a sort of a safe alternative to fossil fuels, but actually it isn't. And I thought they played that game, you know. You didn't hear anything, a lot of talk about rail, but in actual terms of any real meaty substance, nothing in terms of the impetus behind the environmental shift that was needed. And as I said in my contribution, no mention at all about workers or the social wage, even when he was asked when, if they were serious, they could play a role in conditioning a lot of the big money now that's going to transport companies post-COVID, conditioning some of that money to do to securing jobs and green measures. But there was none of that coming back. This is about saving big business, really. like, you know, and it was a bit squary, but I did find his contributions on those things. But I mean, look, there was talk about night trains and all the rest of it, the talk, but I suppose it's the point we were making earlier, how much clout do they really have and how much of their mark can they put on it in a different way? This, I suppose, is different in that you've the marrying of the actual leaders of the European Council holding the reins at the same time when we all know even when they don't hold the reins, they pull the strings anyway. So
yeah. Let's listen to the health minister. This is with Jens Spahn. So that was you, Mick, in the Environment Committee.
Minister Spahn, you're saying that it's very difficult to fight a virus if confined by national borders. Obviously, you addressed the issue of national competencies in health and not one size fits all. But do you not think that the EU and ye now in your presidency should be driving for a properly funded public sector that values public health over profit?
A national health system is not enough to get through this type of pandemic. However good your health system is, a purely public state-funded health system is not sufficient to get through this type of crisis. If you look at the US, which has a purely private system, that clearly isn't the answer either. Many citizens over months or weeks had no access to tests or treatment because they had didn't have the necessary funds. So we have to try and find a balance in a social market economy where we have contributions from private companies and public bodies as well. And we're talking about for everybody access to the necessary tests. Well, we've had the opportunity to study this issue in Germany, having the GDR, the communist East Germany. The data has shown that the state-funded health systems did not have better results than the privately funded system. So we do have to find a balance. We do have to find some middle ground.
Another guy that didn't like answering questions. One part of my questions that he did answer was when I put it to him that that surely one of the big lessons from COVID has been that, you know, when the trouble arrived, it was the state, the public sector, the taxpayer, bailing out the private sector again. The state having to pick up the can for the fact that so many things, so many areas of health have been privatised over the years. But yet, when there's a problem, the onus and responsibility goes back to the state and the public sector. And when I was trying to make the point in my contribution with him that surely something that we should have learned from this crisis is that we need to invest a lot more in the public sector and not to be so reliant on the private sector. And in his response, he actually used the excuse that the public sector in communist East Germany wasn't working great before unification. And he took that as an example of, you know, be careful what you wish for, and that the public sector isn't everything that it's built up to be either. Now, for me, it was a pathetic response to use any situation in Eastern Germany as an excuse for a European approach today. So I was actually very disappointed in him, but he did come across as being strong in his work, but I found his line of thinking to be seriously disappointing.
That's probably the line they use of people at home when they're cutting public services. They say, oh, do you want to go back to those communist days? But I mean, as we saw in COVID, in actual fact, the Germans cut their health services less than anyone else, so they're kind of happy to impose that sort of stuff on the rest of us. But when it comes to being at home, they don't preach the same lesson, you know.
Without a shadow of a doubt, it was real obvious in how they were handling COVID. They were on a different level to the other European countries because they could afford not to be hit with the austerity that a lot of us were in the last 10, 12 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you take a state like Lombardia in Italy, one of the wealthiest states in Italy, population of 16 million. Over half the people in Italy that died of coronavirus came from Lombardia region. It was incredibly badly hit. And people say that 15 years ago that Lombardia had one of the best health services on the planet. But it's been undermined. And
they reached a point with so many people getting coronavirus, so many people being admitted to hospital for help, they ended up having to pick and choose between people who they could save and who they couldn't. Old people were sent home to die in Lombardia, which is unbelievable.
So health minister, yay or nay?
Didn't like
him. You can guess the result now on all of these now.
You, Claire, I didn't ask you for the transport minister. What would you say?
I can't even remember him. I don't even know his name. So that'll tell you, that kind of sums that up. You know?
And what about the justice minister? This is Seehofer, I believe. You had a go at him.
Seehofer. And the only reason I know that is that our Libe chair speaks multiple languages. And he doesn't get, he's a Spanish guy, and he doesn't get the opportunity to practice his German much. So he was delighted. So we kept hearing, so bitte, you know, Herr Seehofer, etc., etc., as he tried to brag away in his German. But a capable fellow, this guy now, serious piece of stuff. And I suppose, unsurprisingly, the big issue in the Libe portfolio, which isn't as big an issue in Ireland but dominates in terms of mainland Europe, is of course migration. And he spent most of his time speaking about that. He told us that, you know, we're going to be speaking about this for a long time, and he wants a solution now. People know that what Europe is faced with, and a key file which will need to be advanced in this presidency, will be the replacement of the Dublin Agreement. And this was the agreement that has given a rise to a lot of the problems on Europe's borders, where people are in the appalling camps that they are in Greece and other areas as they're application to join the European, or to access the European Union, is assessed. So these are these hotspots that they effectively created by this Dublin Agreement, which meant that the place you land, you would be adjudicated as to whether you could come in to the rest of Europe. It's resulted in big problems for Greece, Italy, Spain, Cyprus to a lesser extent, and has meant that other countries have just, I hate the slogan, and it's appalling to talk about people like this, but this is the way they call it. They say, haven't taken their fair share, which sounds mad. Now, Germany, ironically, has taken in more refugees than anybody else. Cute enough out. They know it makes economic sense. It gives them young, healthy, active workers who reinvigorate their economy, and it's brilliant for their economy. Clever boys and girls there. But they are under pressure as well from some of their people, and you see it. I mean, there were loads of Germans at the meeting. Now, the Germans, there's more German MEPs than any other country, but there were people speaking at these committees this week that I've never seen, and most of them were German. Kind of, they want to question their own. On a lighter note, I thought it was ironic that a whole number of the lead speakers wanted to talk about this separated couples problem, which is a kind of a COVID overhang with the borders being closed, that some people who had boyfriends or girlfriends from America were separated from them and they couldn't be reunited with them. But obviously there's a big major campaign going on in Germany that they were all being lobbied with it, because one after the other, the Germans were getting up and they were speaking about Tanya and Heidi and Anke, who's, you know, boyfriend was stuck somewhere else, and is going, oh, for feck's sake, like, you know,
so that's what
100% and your man was saying, and he said, and more than a minute, their coordinators were given slots for this, and your man was reassuring them that love was going to be saved in Europe. Meanwhile, for the poor refugees, the picture wasn't so pleasant. And while they were saying they would look at the Dublin file and that there needed to be solidarity and we need to address this, which of course we do, there's some really scary things in what the Germans are talking about, particularly the idea of continuing to outsource a lot of our, I suppose, asylum priorities or responsibilities to other third countries, the likes of the Turkeys and the Libyas, and people being sent back to those areas, which on the one hand they're saying, oh, no, they're not safe and people aren't going to be sent back. But we know on a daily basis people are. So as you heard, like I was asking them about where they're going to stop putting European money into countries which are not adhering to people's international rights, but they definitely aren't, you know. Mm. And as I said, there's a contradiction there, because there were some really awful far-right speakers given out to the Germans for kind of being too liberal, which they're not. And then on the others, we were given out to them from the point of view that they haven't done enough to ensure that international law is upheld. But you can see the complexities and, the divisions that exist in German society, because the German delegations totally dominated the discussion, and there are loads of them.
I'm still trying to get over that, the fact that some MEPs would prioritise this separated couples issue over. This is a committee that deals with all asylum, like, completely. So everything to do with asylum data, judiciary matters. Like
your own political group managed to get a mention of it in as well, Damien.
God.
Not saying, but not by
I
me.
I just think that's a crisis of priorities if you have 2 minutes to ask a question to a minister. Anyway, let's cheer ourselves up with some AKK. This is the Defence Minister of German. What's her of Germany? What's her real name there, Claire?
Go for it. I think it's Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer. Now, whether that's right or not, I think AKK is easier.
Yeah, your German is pretty good.
Thank you. Thank you, Sean, Herr Wallace.
Well,
thank
anyway,
you, Sean.
AKK is that homophobe who was due to take over for Angela Merkel, but thankfully she's out of the race. But now she's a defence minister. I don't know if that's a step up, but
some woman to talk anyway, that's for sure. She could not. She talked so much that my turn to speak was cut from the.
So the two of you were listening to her today, wasn't it? This afternoon.
At length, great length.
Yeah, both of us are on security and defence, and she was. It was a joint meeting between AFID, the Foreign Affairs Committee, and Security and Defence Committee. So anyway, luckily I got 2 minutes, as you may have heard, to question her.
Delighted with his 2 minutes, you can see.
I didn't spare her, but surprise, surprise, she refused to answer any of my questions.
Oh, let's listen to it.
Minister, your predecessor, Ursula von der Leyen, worked hard to override commitments made in light of the Saudi Arabia-led genocide in Yemen and the murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi. Sadly, business won out over human rights. Since January 19, the German government has approved arms exports worth over $1 billion to members of the Saudi-led coalition, bombing the people of Yemen and intentionally starving them to death in one of the most brutal Western-backed wars in the last century. Is this what European values are about? Do you not think that the time has come for Germany to set a good example for Europe, to stop enabling the French in their desperate dependence on arms sales to poor actors, help them to stop treating the countries of the Sahel the way the US has historically and continues to treat the countries of South America? And is it not time for Europe to develop a more independent foreign policy from the US in the interest of the future stability of the planet and international peace? We need to stop this insanity where we are profiting from the genocide of the Yemeni people and doing nothing to object to the now numerous brutal sanctions regimes imposed by the US, while we go along with bogus claims of human rights abuses against those who try to act independently of an increasingly bellicose US government. Minister, do you not agree that Germany is perfectly placed to secure and advance more mature relations with our neighbours in Russia, China, Iran, Syria? It would make sense that it would be in the interest of the European people and that Germany, as the leading player in Europe, has the potential to do just that.
You won't have to play her response because she didn't give one. I was actually a bit taken aback. It's funny, I don't think of the Germans. I always think of the Germans as being very singular in their thinking and very strong and have minds of their own, and the kind of, you know, they don't let anyone push them around, including the Americans. But this one is from the Pentagon, right? She is unbelievable, right? She was so pro-US in everything they do and unquestioning of US foreign policy and the need to strengthen it further, and so anti-Russian. I'm actually kind of wondering where they found her. In the last couple of years, the Americans have been putting pressure on the Germans to be taking less gas from the Russians. Mm-hmm. But the Russians know that they need Russia, or the Germans know that it's in their interest to buy gas from Russia at the moment. And they keep buying it, and they just ignore the Americans. And they just keep buying it. They do what suits Germany. But this one today now, oh God, I just hope that she doesn't have a big influence on European defence policy in the next few years, because it's really scary. Now, the idea of some of our poor lads at home now standing up to this one now. God, my heart.
I think you're right. It is interesting. You're totally right. Like, Germany is kind of characterized as being the consensus builders, you know, up against the hawkish French, who are a lot more sort of gung-ho in Africa, and that we don't expect the same type of behaviour from the Germans. They talk a much more conciliatory talk and business rules. But actually, when I was listening to her, and I didn't get a chance to ask her questions, but what I would have asked her is, to me, what was screaming out was, it was business talking. Like, I wanted to put to her was, I said, right, you are, there's a couple of funds here, and there's the European Peace Facility Fund, 8 billion fund, which now means that Europe can sell arms and weapons to the likes of militaries in Africa and so on. And what I was going to put to her, how is that going to make the world safer? I also wanted to ask her was, how much of PESCO and their, you know, sort of total love in with PESCO is being driven by the German arms industry. But I didn't get a chance to ask her, but I didn't need to, because to me, everything she was saying is that this is arms industry driven. There are huge German companies, arms companies, where billions of European citizens' money is going to be filtered into their pockets through the vehicles like the EPF and the PESCO character. And that's what this game is about. And the Russian demonization was hilarious. I wanted to ask her about that. I mean, she was condemning Russia for its role in Libya. I didn't see the Russians organizing any regime change in Libya, which some European states did, and I've stood over. And I mean, her thing was, we need to have a common threat. And she's kind of really reprimanding other countries that they didn't see Russia as the big enemy. And I wanted to come in and say, well, Russia isn't an enemy of Ireland. So how are you going to get this consensus on a common threat when the common threat doesn't exist and nobody else sees it? But this is big business talking. Well, it's scary.
Germany is the fourth biggest arms producer in the world. So it's really, and they really have a close ties with their own industry. They have very well organized industries, really push their agenda, and they get their way. So,
and do you know that they brought less than two years ago, the Germans introduced a measure which said that they would stop arms sales to any of the actors involved in the war in Yemen, where millions of citizens are at starvation level. And but in actual fact, the arms sales from Germany to bad actors in Yemen, part of the Soviet or the Saudi coalition, have continued. And in since the 1st of January this year alone, over €1 billion worth of German arms have got a license to be sold to bad actors in Yemen. It's really disgraceful. I mean, millions of people are in dire poverty. There's over 100,000 children alone that have been killed in Yemen. And it's okay because it suits French, UK and German arms manufacturers. It's a disgrace.
And they're thinking of different ways all the time to boost their balance sheets. I mean, one of the key objectives and commitments in PESCO is to consolidate the supply and centralise demand in the European defence market and to standardise military equipment. Now, part of that procurement thing means that when the big contracts go out to tender, it's inevitably the big companies, the big arms companies, that are going to benefit the most. And the German companies, the Rheinmetall, the ThyssenKrupp and all them, or whatever it's called, they're the ones who are going to be cleaning up from this. And when she was speaking, that's what. So they kind of need demons, and the Russians are coming, was the sort of thing. The Russians are on our board because they need to justify that. And then, of course, you had other fellas coming in, kind of going on, there's nothing wrong with those Russians. They're okay. It's the Chinese we should be after. And it doesn't matter who we're after. At the end of the day, it's the arms companies that are raking in the cash. And, and that, I think, is what is driving her. But she.
Without Russia. Right, without Russia, the Europeans would actually struggle to come up with an enemy that would actually justify spending billions on arms.
I mean, when you look at it, like we were saying, like research shows that over the past 35 years, 77% of violent conflicts ended through peace agreements, while only 16% ended through a military victory. So why are we spending all this money on militarism? Exactly. Because when they justify it to us, they're telling you this is about peace and security. But the evidence showed that it isn't. It's making the world more insecure and less peaceful. But I mean, it becomes second nature here. They call things their opposites, really, don't they? But I mean, it is to justify that expenditure, when the reality is, if we were not robbing the global south, if we were not arming people going into other countries, not making people refugees, we could save a load of money to put into our health service.
It is this thing of like cutting through the rhetoric and following the money and seeing who's getting what, whose interests are at stake. Why are these interests being so well defended? And in the end of the day, it's because the power rests in the hands of these CEOs of big industrial arms producers.
And so we now find ourselves spending more on the border security than we ever spent before. They say that the migrants and refugees are a threat to our security. But in actual fact, what they forget to tell us is that there's over 60 million people in the world displaced today, and over 35 million of them have been displaced because of war. And so we're involved in a lot of the wars. We support all of America's wars, and America drops more bombs in the world every year than the rest of the world put together. And yes, Europe has backed it. So we're creating migrants and refugees. Then we put up, we spend a whole lot of money building border fences to stop them from coming in. And we're wasting all this money, all for what? To promote the arms industry, the best lobbyist in town nowadays.
I thought one of the ironic things was, because, I mean, you're right, that, and we've mentioned it before, about these new defence budgets which never existed before. And that's absolutely disgraceful. But actually, one of the only benefits of COVID has been that some of those budgets have been attacked a bit. So there's now less money going to go than had been originally intended to some of those defence projects. And my God, the boys and girls on the CETA committee don't like that.
And it's only a scratch. I'm sure.
A lot of that. So most of their contributions today were decrying the fact that our defence budget was being cut, that we were putting the security of Europe on the line. These people, half of them are crazy, but they come from, we've about four or five former defence ministers, there's chiefs of staff of the armed forces. The Eastern Europeans, we could do a programme on them themselves. It's just incredible to see the influence. And a lot of them go on afterwards to work for these big corporations after they finish as MEPs. Scary stuff. That's what's going on here.
But let's go back to AKK. Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, whatever that's... Is that all right, Claire?
Oh, yeah, sounds grand. Yeah or nay?
I think I've picked up a pretty negative vibe now, but...
Nine, and that's not nine out of ten, that's just nine.
Be afraid, be very afraid.
Okay, I just want to ask a few other questions then before we finish up. I was looking at the priorities document there of the presidency as we went through them all. One thing that stands out to me is that there's nothing on Brexit, our favourite thing to talk about ever, when this is a very defining moment for Brexit. We're talking about the last few months of negotiations. We have a very real threat of there being a complete mess up now at the end of the year, and we're not going to have an actual plan going forward with this. Is it Brexit on the back burner for the Germans, do you think?
I would say that the Germans got tired of the Brexit process, and I'd say they've definitely had enough of it by now. And I also think that there's a number of... there's a lot of meetings going on at the moment about Brexit with all the different committees. I know a good few people involved in it, right? And they say that it could not be more frustrating. I get the impression that the Brits are really not engaging, and that they are just playing ducks and drakes with them. And the Europeans are looking to do deals, and the Brits are kind of ducking and diving, almost avoiding it at the moment. Whether they'll do deals at the very end, at the last minute, I don't know. It's very hard to predict. But listen, Brexit has been impossible to predict all along. And we argued in our last couple of years, even in the Dáil, that there was no sense in the amount of time. While Brexit was a huge issue for Ireland, we had so little influence over the final outcome, because it was the final outcome was always going to be something that the British would decide, and we exhausted ourselves talking too much about it.
That's exactly what has come to happen. Like, we spent three of the 4 years in the second Dáil term that we had were totally dominated by Brexit. Every newspaper, every article, people were sick of it. And if you compare that now to the going from all day, every day to zero, it doesn't even get a mention now. That's very suspicious in many ways as well. And it's a real indictment of the media, because there are actually severe problems with the talks and the negotiations that are going on now, and it's not being discussed anywhere. So on the one hand, was the first bit totally exaggerated? Yes, it was. It's really gone too far with no coverage. I don't think it's a problem with the Germans. I think it's everybody has sort of moved on. I mean, it's like the Brits were never here.
Yeah, nobody maybe that's the message. Them. Maybe yeah. that's the message of saying, look, we're fine without you, and yeah. these are our priorities the next 6 months. And Brexit isn't mentioned once in the whole yeah. programme document. So it's interesting.
But it will put it back into Fine Gael's camp as well, because we were told that these were their friends and Europe were going to look after little Ireland and we weren't going to be left behind and they'd loads of promises and all the rest of it. But now nobody's even that bothered about it, you know. So it is one to watch.
Yeah. And the last thing I wanted to ask you about is this whole thing of the economic recovery post-pandemic. We already have the next generation funds and everything and all these recovery funds coming forward. But the Germans are now in charge at the council side. So what kind of recovery is this going to be? What are you expecting?
Well, when it comes to money, the Germans make the decisions. When the notion of a Eurobond was floated initially by the Italians and backed up by 8 other countries, including Ireland, within hours, the Germans knocked it on the head. The idea of the Eurobond was going to be shared responsibility across the EU for costs that were going to accrue from COVID. There is going to be some European support for countries in general, but right now, there still isn't near enough. Will that change? Remains to be seen. I think that Europe has to do a lot more. There has to be far more grants, not just loans, to the member states like Ireland and Italy and Spain, who have suffered the most from COVID. Countries that already had huge debt don't need more of it. They need grants. And that's the call of the Germans. If the European Union were to unravel, nobody would lose more than Germany. You know, it'll be a long time before you hear talk of Ireland leaving the European Union. Ireland is still madly in love with it. But the Italians, if there was a referendum in Italy today, will we stay or will we go? Automatically, I guarantee you, it would be no contest. The Germans would leave, or the Italians would leave the European Union. Italy is very unhappy with what's happening. And if Italy is not well treated and supported in post-COVID, there'll be big problems.
Yeah, it's a crucial moment. Book time. So, Mick, you had a book the last time. Claire, your turn. You promised me you'd have a book.
So I think, absolutely, this time round, it's going to be A Month by the Sea. By Dervla Murphy, herself an incredible woman now in her 80s, who had spent time in Gaza. And it's about her experiences in Gaza, what she saw on the front line. It's really poetically, brilliantly written and incredibly timely now because of obviously with the greater aggression being demonstrated by the Israeli authorities. I think it's really human and capturing. Just read it yourselves, you won't be sorry. And then have a look at Dervla Murphy. What a legend. And I defy anybody to tell me that there hasn't been a stronger woman in Ireland.
You had to say in Ireland because of Angela Merkel, wasn't it?
Well, no. I don't think Dervla will be happy to hear herself compared of Angela Merkel, but she's a powerhouse. What she did over her decades of activism is really outstanding. She's a travel writer and a great person and an activist.
Now, Damien, you were saying that someone was objecting to me telling stories.
Objecting is a bit much. People
thought...
A bit sensitive here.
I mean, I've been actually getting very good feedback on the stories, but you know what? I've an idea. Why don't we have a little bit of a poll, right? And we should ask people to contact us and let us know, would they rather I tell a story or would they not? And I'll be guided by the majority, by whatever replies we get, and we'll go with the majority.
I'm being
position.
Reminded now of the scandal when Michael Healy-Ray was in the Dáil and had people ringing up to say to vote for him on the celebrity referee program or whatever it was, like, and now, so we don't want.
He only used 3,000 phone
any
calls.
Any Wallances or people from Wexford, right? Or views
actually,
will not be taken into account.
There's a brilliant story around that, which I'll tell the next day.
But can we? It is important that we pay tribute to Jack Charlton in the week that was in it. Legend, of course, of Irish football years, and the Brits, of course, tried to claim him, but he was primarily a working class hero, a socialist, great humanitarian. So
I'll leave on that note. And I
had the pleasure of meeting him in a small bar in somewhere in America during the World Cup in 94. Real small bar, and I, myself and two others had gone in there, and was in the morning it was, right? Just who walks in on Charlton on his own looking for a beer, and I asked him, could I buy him a pint? And he says, yeah, okay, yeah. So I bought him a pint, and I said to him, you know what, Jack, I'd say you're the first English man I ever bought a drink for. And Charlton looks at me, he didn't know what to think, and he says, oh, that's nice.
I thought he was going to say, well, that's not the first time I heard that.
God, you're full of stories.
Well, I have to say, that's the best story you've ever told.
And it was
that's
short
the first
and
time
sweet.
I've heard a story that
oh,
I never
yeah, you
heard
think
before.
My stories are too long. Yeah. I see, okay, right. Anyway, listen,
it's a new story. I've never heard that story before.
I'm looking forward to the poll. Listen, I have thousands of stories, only I've forgotten.
You have thousands of friends as well. You're going to be bribing them all to be voting for you.
No, no, no. I will not contact anyone and encourage them to vote for me telling the stories.
Okay, so any Wallace or somebody from Wexford is barred from taking part in the poll.
Okay, well, we'll bar all the Wallaces. Okay,
fair enough.
That's it. That's our take on the German presidency. We're happy to answer any of your questions or dive into new topics. So get in touch what you'd like to learn about and what you'd like us to chat about. And we'll do our best. So until next time.
Tschüss. See ya. Auf Wiedersehen. Tschüss. Adieu. You know, see ya.
We'll see ya.
Yeah.
Good luck.